بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. If I can take the opportunity to insert here a brief commercial break to inspire you to pay vast sums of money for my latest booklet. One of the hadiths in Bukhari, which Imam Ibn Hajar comments on in this selection, is the hadith al-Nawafil, which I was speaking about a few moments ago. And I think it's because of the possibility, however remote, of a misunderstanding through excessive literalness of this hadith Qudsi, useful to reflect on the various meanings that he offers. I'll read part of this, and you can read the rest. This is where he says, and when I love him, I am his ear with which he hears, his sight with which he sees, etc. Here the problem arises of how the Creator can be a slave's hearing and sight and so on. The answer has several aspects. Firstly, the meaning is, I am his hearing and his sight in his choosing my command, so that he loves my obedience and prefers my service. Secondly, the meaning is, his whole being is occupied with me, so that he listens with his hearing only to what pleases me, and sees with his eye only that which I have commanded him to behold. And he gives another four different interpretations from different ulama. He also explains the meanings that some of the later Sufis have discovered in the hadith. He says, some of the later Sufis apply it to the spiritual degrees, the maqams of annihilation and obliteration. This is fana or mahu. These being the utmost point beyond which is the void. In this station, the Muslim is established by God's establishing him. He loves through God's love for him. He sees through his sight of him, without there remaining with him anything to which a name could be attached or which relates to any matter or can be characterized by any predicate. The meaning of the discourse is that he witnesses Allah's establishment of him so that he is established, Allah's love of him so that he loves him, and his sight of him so that he comes looking to him with his heart. And then he closes by saying, in none of these interpretations is there any scope for the believers in ittihad, or those who believe in absolute unity, al-wahdatu al-mutlaqa, since he says in the remainder of the hadith, if he asks me, I shall surely grant him his request. If he seeks my protection, I shall surely grant him protection. In other words, the human subject still exists. This is not an annihilation of the human subject. Imam Ibn Hajar, a great lover of the Sufis, as is evident throughout his great commentary on Bukhari, is here drawing our attention to the negation by the Sufis of any literalist reading of this hadith that might lead us to the heretical belief in ittihad, that is to say, the uniting of the human being with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is impossible. Two essences, a finite and an infinite, cannot coalesce into a single essence. It's logically impossible. Theologically impossible impugns the very principle of tawheed. Anyway, you can read the rest of that at your leisure. I think it's an important parenthetical comment. What I want to do now is to talk about this dichotomizing that the ulama came up with when looking at the different kinds of ulum. Eventually, as we'll see, they divided knowledges into many hundreds of types. But the two fundamental types which certainly appear in Ghazali's differentiation are knowledges that sustain the soul and knowledges that sustain the body. And we saw that the former has only one source, namely revelation, and the second can have material sources, sensory sources. Now, the second category, the substance of the body, these are the practical material sciences, nowadays what goes by the name of ulum. These are acquired through methods of research, experimentation, empirical observation of the dunya. So the first is, as it were, from the top down, quite superior, and the second is from bottom up. You deduce the abstractions of this science by looking at the differentiations of the world, but the science of the soul comes from above. The ulama also say that the first is the soul of Ayn and the second is the soul of Kifaya. In other words, it's an obligation on every believer to know, to be educated about the state of the soul, because it is upon that that our salvation depends. But it is not a soul of Ayn or an obligation upon every believer to know about medicine or engineering or computer programming or whatever it might be. These can still be useful sciences, but it's not incumbent religiously upon every Muslim to master them. There's also a distinction that you'll find in the work of Imam Abu Mansur al-Maturidi, where he identifies three different kinds of knowledge. Not two different kinds, which is more of an Ash'ari dichotomy, but the Maturidi specifically identify three types of knowledge. Firstly, there is knowledge through sense perception, ayan, the moon is shining, because my sense of sight tells me that, so that's a form of knowledge. Another is inductive knowledge from reasoning, what is known as nazar, through processes of logical induction from first principles. And the science of logical mantiq, very highly developed in classical Islam, was the essential ulum. And the third type in this Maturidi classification is reports from revelation, which they call akhbar. Now, picking up these distinctions and running with them, the classical ulama developed a number of different ways of subdividing the ulum. And these subcategories formed the basis for the curricula that were followed in classical Muslim madrasas. Sometimes we will find that the category of empirical knowledge is subdivided into three different ulum, all of which are regarded as useful sciences: mathematics, physics, and metaphysics. But generally, in later Islamic civilization, we find that the term used, or the differentiation, uses the terms ulum aqliya and ulum naqliya. This comes into being around the 5th or the 6th Islamic century, and it continues to the present day. Most of the ulama legitimize this terminology. The naqliya sciences are the sciences of revelation. Naql means transmission, that which has been handed down to us from an infallible prophet. So, a classical differentiation that you will find in, say, the madrasas of Mughal India and in the Ottoman Empire is to list 9 ulum under the ulum naqliya. First of all, the sciences of Qur'an, particularly memorization and recitation, the qira'ah and hifz. Generally the first topic to be dealt with by small children. Secondly, the meaning of the Qur'an, the interpretation, the tafsir. That's number 2. Number 3 is hadith and its sciences. Number 4 is fiqh. Number 5 is ilm al-kalam. Number 6 is naql and sarh, Arabic grammar and morphology. Number 7, other linguistic sciences, prosody and rhetoric. Number 8, literature, adab, very important in the cultivation of the well-rounded Islamic personality. And number 9, Sufism. That's certainly for the Ottomans the basic way in which they subdivided the ulum naqliya. Under the ulum aqliya, we find in the Ottoman Empire and for the Mughals, and also for better Islamic polities such as the Uzbek Khanate. Number 1 under the aqliya sciences was philosophy or falsafa, Number two, geometry. Number three, astronomy. Number four, medicine, which included the subcategories, botany and biology. Number five, chemistry. Six, mathematics. Number seven was physics. Now, that differentiation has no revealed justification, but it was a subdivision that was found useful by the ulama of the later Islamic period, and in those parts of the Islamic world where some semblance of a traditional Islamic education is still available, that as likely as not the kind of curriculum that you will encounter. What I want to do now, before we break for dinner, is to look in rather more detail at the social context which the Ummah has devised for this process of education. If the religion itself is education, what are the institutions, the frameworks, methodologies, the social context, the attitudes towards learning and the learned that classical Islam has historically favoured? Well, the paradigm is, of course, Rasul ﷺ himself, from the first word, iqra, which suggests that he was to recite, in other words, not just to be taught, but to be a teacher of others. Rasulullah ﷺ has been the great educator, and hence the first teacher and the first model for Islamic educators. What he did in the house of Al-Arqam ibn Abi Al-Arqam, near Safa in Mecca, was to teach. That was the first madrasa of Islam. In Medina, the centre of education was the mosque, and particularly the Safa. And we can say that the most important features of classical Islamic education and institutions and attitudes can be traced back, in most cases, to the usages of the Safa, the veranda, to the south of the house of the Rasul alayhi salatu wasalam in Medina. And again, if by any mischance you haven't yet forked out your several dollars for your copy of the Fath al-Bari translation, there is a footnote. You'll find on page 37, which talks a bit about these Ahl al-Safa, spiritual elite amongst the Sahaba. A number of times hadith speak about them. And one of the early ulama who talked about the Ahl al-Safa and what the Safa means as a kind of first university of Islam was Imam al-Hakim al-Nizaburi, who many of you will know as one of the great hadith compilers of early Islam, also of the great Kitab al-Mustadrak al-Sahihain, in which he lists all of the hadith which meet the conditions for authenticity set by Bukhari and Muslim, but which were not included by them in their collection. And he has a number of other introductory works on hadith. But when he talks about these hadith of the Safa, Imam al-Hakim indicates what was the view of the early hadith scholars on the function of this academic institution. So he writes, "I have pondered these hadiths concerning the people of the Safa, and I found them to be among the greatest of the Sahaba in scrupulousness, in wara, and tawakkul, and in constant service of Allah and His Messenger. For them, Allah chose what He chose for His Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, by way of poverty, neediness, and humbleness in worship of Allah and leaving the dunya to its people. They are the group to which the Sufis belong, generation after generation. So that whoever follows their sunnah and their patient endurance of renouncing the things of this world, and their familiar intimacy with poverty, and their refusal to beg, are in every age the followers of the Ahl al-Safa and the people of reliance upon their Creator." Obviously, as a good grammarian, Imam al-Hakim couldn't accept the spurious etymology of the word Sufi from Safa. Sometimes it's said that the word Sufi actually comes from the Safa, but any basic knowledge of Arabic morphology will tell you that that's not the case, and early Arab users of the language would never have devised such an etymology. But for Imam al-Hakim, as one of the great hadith scholars, certainly the Suffa are the early paradigm, the authenticating paradigm for the discipline of Sufism, because of their gathering together in one place, because their institution is an institution of learning, because of their proximity to a holy teacher, and because of their awareness of the baseness of the dunya in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There were perhaps 70 of the Ahl al-Suffa, according to some estimations as many as 300, but we have lists of about 70. So that, if you like, is the first educational institution of Islam, Islam in its developed form. These people were not just taught fiqh and the ahkam, but they were also transformed by the presence of the Rasul alayhi salatu wasalam. So it was, so from the very outset of education in Islam, we may say that Islam sought to cultivate the entire human being. The fiqh, which is for the body, and the tasawwuf, which is for the soul. One without the other leaves the human being partial, lopsided. Now, after the death of Mustafa, a number of the Sahaba continued the traditions of the Ahl al-Suffa, teaching in the mosque, and the mosque itself becomes university, if we have to use a modern term. And the great teachers were people like Aisha, Ibn Omar, Zayd bin Thabit, radiallahu anhum, and a number of others. These were the people amongst the Sahaba whose proximity to the Rasul, those three people in particular, had qualified them to pass down the ilm, which was the meaning of the Quran, and correct fatwas concerning the proper application of the Sunnah. So that's the beginning of education in Islam, and we can say that the very early traditions have been maintained today. Not so much in the Western style universities in the Islamic world, which, depressingly enough, have believed that one can adopt a form of Western education without importing also much of its ethos and its content. Islam is not best taught to people sitting on chairs with desks separating them physically and hence symbolically from the teacher. Islam is not best taught through a system of examinations, 2 or 3 weeks after which everybody has forgotten everything they knew. Islam is not best taught through institutions with cumbrous bureaucracies, with degree certificates. Islam is not best taught with blackboards, overhead projectors, and the other accoutrements of a modern university, although most modern Islamic universities seem to think that this is just fine. It's another measure of our decadence. Traditional Islam is taught according to the Sunnah. It's no good teaching the Sunnah if you're not teaching with the Sunnah. People have to be actualizing what they are learning. So in that early period, we see the classical pattern of Islamic learning unfolding. Namely, that it is a human transaction. That the religious integrity of the teacher is all important. That the teacher must have received knowledge himself or herself from the teacher. That it is without precedent in Islamic education for a teacher simply to have educated himself or herself from a book, to be an autodidact, and then to hold forth to students. That's not how Islam is, because Islam is about the transmission, not just about a form, but also of content. The student must be transformed not just by the words of the teacher, but also by his ahwal. His aqwal and also his ahwal. The teacher himself must exemplify the knowledge. And this is something that is very remote from the modern Western conception. where the idea of the teacher as a morally or spiritually superior person has almost been lost sight of completely. Now, what actually took place in the primordial university of Islam, which was the Haram in Medina, was fairly free in its form and content. Classical Islamic education is, by modern standards, remarkably relaxed, open-ended, informal, although certainly a dignity and a reverence exists between the teacher and pupil. Nonetheless, in terms of organisation, structuring, timetabling, things are much more informal than is the case in the very interestingly regimented educational environment of the modern West. We do have some information about how classes were allocated. We know that Sayyidina Ibn Abbas, radiallahu anhu, one of the great early educators of Islam, a great expert on the Quran, used to divide his time day by day, so that one day would be for a particular subject, after which he would switch to another subject. And he had a kind of rota. So one day he would speak on tafsir, the next day he would speak on fiqh, the next day he would speak on futuh, which means seerah and the early history of the ummah. The next day would be on poetry and literature, and then he would start again. So it was quite a common pattern. The actual timing of the lectures, something which in the most traditional circles has continued to this day. It was assumed that the mind was at its most retentive in the morning. And so most Muslim institutions historically have functioned from dawn until midday. We find this in the life of Imam al-Ghazali, in the Madrasas in his time. In Al-Azhar University today, teaching tends to be in the morning. We know as early as the time of Al-Hasan al-Basri that he would teach from dawn till midday, and it's sometimes said that he is the one who instituted this tradition in the Ummah. We know also a little bit later that Imam al-Shafi'i would begin after Fajr every day teaching Qur'an, after which he would teach Hadith, and then grammar, and then poetry until the noon prayer came. Another recurrent feature of classical Islamic education was that it didn't cost anything. Another surprising fact to those of us used to exorbitant college fees nowadays. Mosque education was purely voluntary and was free. This was regarded as one of the duties of the ulama that they would teach. They wouldn't expect any reimbursement for their services. And where the institution insisted that they accepted, they would frequently give the money discreetly to the poor. Or like Imam Ibn Abbad al-Zundi, the great professor of the Qarawiyyin in Fez, when he died and they lifted up his pillow, they found all of the money that he had been paid, and with a message that it was to be given for a particular waqf for the benefit of the students and for construction to benefit them. In the fullness of time, the tradition of teaching in the mosques became somewhat cumbrous and unwieldy because the number of students increased so greatly. Particularly when Islamic cities became enormous and the desire for knowledge became so widespread that you would have quite commonly, for instance in the Hadith classes of the Khatib al-Baghdadi, over 10,000 students attending a single class, with mu'eeds, people repeating the words of the sheikh so that the people in the back rows could hear. Remember, this is before the advent of microphones. It became somewhat unwieldy to have the mosques absolutely packed with people studying. And in central Islamic lands, the institution of the madrasa developed, around about the 5th century of Islam. Madrasa also, of course, was a mosque if you go there and pray. Besides, many prayers were established there. But it was understood that the primary function of the madrasa was the inculcation of the ulum, perhaps a particular type of ilm. The madrasas were specialised in particular madahib or particular Islamic disciplines. The institution of the Darul Hadith, for instance, made it self-explanatory. Sometimes also the mosques would remain as Masjid Jami', but would also remain as university mosques, in which case separate teaching halls would be established. Al-Azhar Mosque in Cairo, an obvious example of this, large halls that are worked were established over the centuries, built adjacent to the main teaching hall, so that the teaching wouldn't get in the way of people who just wanted to go in to read the Quran or to pray outside the times of prayer. We also find around this time, the 4th and the 5th century of Islam, that a separation of function takes place with regard to primary education. Typically in medieval Islam and in traditional communities to the present day, small children from the age of about 7 to 10 would attend very elementary school, usually known as the maktab, where the focus would be entirely on the memorizing of the Quranic text. Perhaps they would memorize in the last year there a few other texts, basic mutun, versified summaries of fundamental Islamic disciplines. And then from the age of 10 to about the age of 13, depending on the period and the geographical area, they would go to another slightly more developed institution, usually known as the Kutab, where these mutun would be diversified, they would learn a lot more of them, and they would begin to learn commentaries on the mutun as well. The other thing that happens in the 4th and 5th centuries is that you find the construction of really enormous madrasas. Not just small corners for the inculcation of a particular discipline, but large, often quite showy monuments to the religious piety of a particular ruler, which would include the teachings of all four madhabs. So the so-called cruciform madrasa, which becomes very widespread indeed, begins at this period, namely a madrasa that has four main iwans or arches, each of which and the attendant rooms would be dedicated to the instruction of one of the four canonical madahib. Sometimes also you find that madrasas develop not next to mosques but next to tombs. The tomb of Imam Abu Hanifa in Baghdad was always a great magnet for ulama and for teachers and students. I believe it continues in reduced circumstances to this day. This is the so-called Mashhad Madrasa in Baghdad. Medieval Islam, particularly, obviously, for the Hanafi and Maturidi ulama, one of the great magnets for scholars. Interestingly, this madrasa system, because of its success, becomes the model for what is known as the studia, the medieval colleges in Europe, when for the first time education started to happen outside the walls of the monasteries. The model that was adopted was the Islamic model. If you read a book by George McAtee called The Rise of Colleges, it explains very clearly how the Western University as it exists today has a pedigree stretching right back to the medieval Seljuk madrasas of the Near East. Teaching didn't just go on in mosques and in madrasas. However, there are a number of other contexts developed by Islamic civilization in which one could get an education. One of these was a place known as the Ribat. A Ribat is a kind of residential jihad college where the principal duty of those residing, the young men who had spent some years of their life residing in this fortress on the frontier, would be to guard the frontier against the Byzantines, the pagan Turks, the Spanish, or the Vikings, or whoever. And if you ever visit Spain, one of the interesting things you can do is to visit an archaeological site quite close to Alicante, which has recently been excavated, and which turns out to be an Umayyad ribat, very early, from the Umayyad Caliphate. Remember that Umayyads last a lot longer in Spain than they do elsewhere, from the time of Abdurrahman III. And the archaeologists, I think Spanish and German, who have unearthed this fairly large complex, which is on the sand dunes next to the sea, were amazed to discover that every one of the rooms where the students would live had its own little mihrab. There was a large space where obviously some form of military training would take place, presumably archery would go on there, fencing and the other Islamic arts of war. But the students were clearly required or expected also to be, or bared to be, worshippers, to the extent that each one of their rooms had its own little mihrab, and you can still clearly see them after 1,000 years today. So the Ribat is an important place for worship and for learning the arts of jihad, but in these places also you could be educated, because you weren't training to be a soldier, you weren't fighting physically at the front line all the time. You would use the rest of your time studying. Some of the great hadith scholars would seek out the barakah of the surur, the frontiers, by spending time with these young men at the frontiers and instructing them. Another institution that developed variously known as the Khan or the Riwaq, very important particularly in the Mamluk period, some of the greatest of our ulama emerged from these establishments, were places that were primarily established as halls of residence. This is the meaning of the Riwaq. There were some 30 at Al-Altar alone. Often at those international universities where a plurality of Muslim nationalities were represented, you would find that although the teaching was given indifferently in the mosque to members of the different nationalities, all in Arabic of course, nonetheless the different nationalities, the Moroccans, the Palestinians, the Turks, the Tatars, the Swahili, Africans and the rest, would have their own institutions near the mosque, each of which would be under the direction of a sheikh. So a hall of residence was itself a kind of madrasa, rather austere, almost monastic setting, in which a sheikh would preside, usually a sheikh from that nationality. If they were from northern Nigeria, he would be a Fulani or a Hausa or a Borunawi or whatever, so as to understand the culture of the students that he was supervising, and to be a bridge between them and the Arabic culture of the institution. Similarly, if he was from Tatarstan or from Bosnia or wherever, he would be from those areas. And his responsibility would be pastoral, making sure that the students weren't getting into moral trouble. He'd make sure that they were financially stable, so that they were getting the grant to which they were entitled. And he would also make sure that they were filling their spare time not with futility, but with useful learning. The learning would take place not just in the mosque or in the madrasa, but also in the halls of residence. Another place where you could learn in classical Islam was the library. Quite often, the libraries of the medieval Islamic world, which were by far the largest libraries in the world, had their own lecture halls attached, where visiting scholars would be invited to give lectures, where discussions would take place, the equivalent of a modern seminar situation. Sometimes disputes would take place. And the library, nowadays almost completely neglected as a centre for Islamic education in the sense of public instruction, was hugely important for medieval Muslims. Now the context was the Maristan, or the hospital. Hospitals were not just places for curing the sick, usually free of charge, but also provided facilities for teaching. Not just teaching medicine, but for teaching those sciences that were regarded as being indispensable for the well-rounded healing of patients. So that, for instance, in the Ottoman Empire, one of the most important disciplines taught in these institutions was music therapy. Simply think of music therapy as a modern Western invention. Very important now in hospitals in England, probably in this country as well, because it's established that certain forms of instrumental music can have a healing effect on certain mental diseases. It's a well-known fact. And the Ottomans also knew this, and so did the medieval Persians and the Uzbeks. So if you visit one of the greatest of all Islamic educational complexes, which is the Kulliya of Sultan Bayezid, late 15th century, just out of the Bulgarian border, one of the most beautiful of all Ottoman structures, you will see the classical features of an Ottoman Muslim university: halls of residence, soup kitchen, the teaching hall, the mosque at the centre of everything, the library. But you will also see this Sama'khana, or this place where instruction will be given in the use of music therapy, and where the mentally ill would be brought to hear certain types of music, certain modes would be played to them after the physician would recite the nature of the patient's illness.
And that itself was sophisticated science requiring an education institution. So hospitals also partook in the big enterprise of Islamic education. Another important place where you could receive an education in classical Islam was the Khanaqa, an institution dating from largely from the Seljuk period, 4th or the 5th century, associated with people like Imam al-Juwayni and Imam al-Ghazali. The Khanaqa was primarily established as a centre for esoteric instruction, for the cultivation of the Sufi disciplines of the Sharia. Very often they would be under the jurisdiction of a particular tariqa, or a particular sheikh, or a particular family. But the Khanaqas, because of the importance of Sufism in society at large, were also places for the inculcation of exoteric sciences as well. The sheikh of the Khanaqa might well be revered primarily as the possessor of a particular initiatic lineage, a silsila, but he would, as often as not, also be a great exoteric scholar in his own right. Imam al-Ghazali, in his declining years, taught at precisely such an institution, one that he himself established and taught. And Imam Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani spent the 20 most productive years of his life teaching at the Khanaqa, the Sufi lodge of Sultan Baybars in Cairo. So the image that's very widespread amongst Muslims, which is that education took place primarily in the mosque and the madrasa, really is an oversimplification. Education was so important that it took place in just about every institution that the society had. It took place, to be sure, in the mosques and in the madrasas, but also in the libraries, also in halls of residence, also in the hospitals, also in these ribats, these military fortresses, and also in the Sufi khanaqas. Techniques of teaching. These were intricate, but certain standard conventions that came to be accepted amongst the ulama can be identified. And perhaps the most significant of these is the ijaza system. I mentioned earlier that Islamic knowledge, because it's about the transformation of human beings, has to be handed on by a living human being to a living human being. So that the hadith scholars will say that if you cite a hadith in the creation of a fatwa or in the exercise of ijtihad simply on, as a hadith that you found in a book, that's not valid. That's what they call wijada, finding a hadith in a book, even if it comes with an isnad, is really not acceptable. Nowadays, a lot of fatwa seem to come with those conditions attached, but for classical Islam, that's a shoddy and a makeshift and a dangerous way of delivering a fatwa. The hadith that is truly known and that can be used by the scholar is the hadith that has been inculcated through sama', through hearing it from a living sheikh and being given permission to teach that hadith by that living sheikh, who is himself in turn authorized by other shuyukh, going right back to the Mustafa sallallahu alayhi. And this is a difficult condition, but for classical Islam it's absolutely indispensable. No one could teach unless they were qualified. There was no examination system, by and large. A bunch of students sitting down in a large, drafty hall and ransacking their memory. That would be regarded as an extremely crude method of testing ability by the much more sophisticated academic world of classical Islam. Instead, you could teach when you were authorized to teach by someone who was himself a teacher and really knew you. So the sheikh would, when you had read back his book to him and demonstrated adequate knowledge of it, would write in the flyleaf of the book that I give this ijaza to Sheikh so-and-so to teach this book. And this was an excellent means of securing the ummah from error, because physical texts of books are subject to all kinds of scribal errors, nowadays misprints. Whereas the oral tradition, when you hear a text from somebody, you know how everything is pronounced, you exercise your powers of memory to memorize it, is far more effective, far less likely to go astray. And this is absolutely axiomatic. The traditional Islamic education really doesn't use books very much. It's primarily an oral tradition based on the nowadays largely neglected science of memorization. There were degrees of being a scholar. The beginning was known as a Talib, seeker of knowledge. Next there would be the Mu'id, who would be authorized, because of his teacher's trust in him, to repeat what the teacher was saying to people in the back rows. Then there would be the Mu'lazim, the better student, the more experienced student, would keep the company of the Shaykh constantly and would be, as it were, designated as the Shaykh's successor should the Shaykh be ill or should the Shaykh die. And finally, one would become the Shaykh. Those were the four stages through which everybody had to pass in the classical Islamic system. Should we stop at this point? Alhamdulillah, we have other things now waiting for us. Thank you for your patience, and inshallah, I will see you again tomorrow. Wa akhiru da'wana. And alhamdulillahi ta'ala, Rabbil Alameen.